You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach, talking National League East with MLB.com's NL East beat reporters. Taking a look at Mike Minor in the back of the rotation when we talk Atlanta Braves. We talk Phillies. We'll be looking at Jonathan Papelbon, the arrival of Michael Franco, and what they do with Cody Ashe. With the Washington Nationals, we'll be talking Steven Strasburg and Bryce Harper. Mets, we'll be taking a look at Noah Syndergaard and the offense, as well as some injury updates. And talking Miami Marlins, taking a look at Henderson Alvarez and the ninth inning. We'll start with what I think is the topic of the week in Mets land, which is Noah Syndergaard. The line, I think it's fair to say, did not really do him justice. It was a somewhat uninspiring pitching line, but I think to my eye, and I suspect to yours, he was awfully impressive. What did you see from Syndergaard in his first big league start?
Yeah, you can't really look at the line because sort of everything negative that happened in two spots. One was in the sixth inning at the very end just before he came out, and he gave up three quick hits, three quick runs, and that sort of ruined it for him. And the other spot was earlier in the game when sort of a routine ground ball at the third base, and Daniel Murphy just acted really slow on it. Would have been the last out of the inning. Instead, Chris Bryant gets an infield hit, and Noah Syndergaard has to wind up throwing 18 more pitches that inning. There were a couple walks thrown in there. So really, a lot of the bad things that happened shouldn't overshadow the good, which was this guy comes up, and this guy who sort of there have been questions about him throughout his minor league career of can he handle the big stage? Does he have the makeup for this? Matt Harvey, he is not in terms of personality and all that. But he really seemed to embrace it. He seemed to do a good job. He came out firing 98-mile-an-hour fastballs. He obviously has that power curve. The changeup is improving, and we saw a little bit of all of that. What I liked out of Noah Syndergaard in his debut was just that. He was using his off-speed stuff a lot. He wasn't going out there, which I think is a fear of some Mets people, going out there and saying, hey, I've got this 98-99, I'm just going to rear back and throw and see if you can hit it. Because as we know, big league hitters can hit that if they know it's coming. He looks much more like a pitcher than we've seen at points in the past from him. And if he can continue to do that, I think everyone realizes and knows that his sheer stuff is as good as pretty much anyone in the league. So he'll get guys out as long as he continues pitching and continues really performing like he did in his debut.
Well, you work in New York, so I don't have to apologize for getting way ahead of ourselves and being ridiculous here. I don't think it's ridiculous. I do think it's getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. But I do want to ask, is there an opportunity for him, is there a chance that he could pitch, show something, do something that he's in the rotation for good now, or is it for sure that if Dylan G's recovery goes sort of as normal, he's back in the rotation when he's healthy again?
Oh, Noah Syndergaard has every opportunity. Just because the Mets won't necessarily say that out loud, I think it's pretty clear for a couple of reasons. One, they've been waiting on this guy for a while. A lot of people thought he would be up last year. It took about a year longer than many expected. But this guy's a big part of their future. They don't like calling guys like that up if they think they're going to have to send them right back down. And if Noah Syndergaard goes out and throws two or three really good games before Dylan G can get back, you're not going to boot him from the rotation. You'll find someone else to remove if and when it comes to that. The other reason is you just never know with injuries. I mean, we've talked so much on this podcast about how much pitching depth the Mets had coming into this season. Well, it's pretty much all gone now. I mean, they had an insane amount of depth, and they've got injuries to Dylan G, Zach Wheeler, obviously, with the Tommy John surgery. Rafael Montero's out sort of indefinitely, and that injury is lingering longer. So you look down in the minor leagues now, and with Syndergaard up, the only sort of big league-ready guy you have down at AAA is Stephen Matz. The depth is pretty much all gone. So just to assume that Dylan G is going to come back and this rotation is going to be healthy and nothing else is going to go wrong, and all of a sudden you're going to have 7-8 guys for 5 spots, it just doesn't usually work out that way. So in a perfect world for the Mets, Noah Syndergaard would go out and pitch great, and you know, maybe Dylan G gets healthy, and then that's a tough decision they'll have to make. But I find it hard to believe that if that's the case, they're going to say, sorry, Noah, you're back in AAA, because this guy really is a huge part of the future for the franchise.
Does he have to be really terrific to make that a tough decision, or does he just have to be sort of good enough to show you flashes of what he's capable of being?
Well, if he shows he's not ready, yeah, he'll go back down. You know, he can't go out and start walking the ballpark and start doing sort of what I was talking about before, trying to blow his fastball by people, not really relying as much on the curve, on the changeup. You know, if he's doing that and showing that he's a little rough around the edges, they'll send him down for more seasons. I mean, they like the staff down there with Wally Backman and Frank Viola and the guys that they have working with the AAA pitchers. So they won't hesitate. I'm not saying by any means this is automatic that Noah Syndergaard is in the rotation for all eternity. But if he performs well, and I don't mean he has to go seven shutout every time, if he shows that he's a major leaguer and he's ready and that he really has nothing else that he needs to prove or work on at AAA, then, yeah, I think he's here to stay, and he certainly has that opportunity to be here to stay.
Yeah, I think that was what I was getting at, is he's sort of somewhere in between, whoa, Matt Harvey, and not ready. If he's sort of that in between, good, but still with work to do, he sticks around, is sounds like what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, it's a challenge in a sense. I mean, it's right there before him. And pitch well, you get to stay. Don't pitch well, you go. I mean, I think that's sort of the pretty clear situation that faces Noah Syndergaard right now. And that's really, you know, if I'm an evaluator, if I'm a coach, if I'm a manager, that's what I want from my young pitchers. I don't want him to be complacent and say, well, you know, I don't have to be amazing to stick around. I've got that job. And nor do I want him to be looking over his shoulder constantly worrying about, you know, if I throw one pitch that's, you know, catches too much of the zone, I'm back in the minors. I think it's a nice little happy medium for him to really see what he can do when he's challenged.
To go to a less pleasing topic, the Mets are not winning a lot lately, and it's pretty easy to look at what's going on. Not only are they not scoring runs, they're not hitting for any power at all. The team slugging percentage is 349. Murphy's at 358. Even Duda, who's having a nice year, is at 446. Kadire's at 371. Granderson's at 360. Nobody in this lineup is hitting for any power. And it seems like that's really what they're going to need to do to score runs. What can they do, if anything, aside from get guys healthy and just wait for this offense to be more like what they thought it was going to be?
Well, of all the guys you mentioned, I look directly first and foremost at Michael Kadire, because everyone else was here last year. We sort of know what they're all about. This isn't a team that's going to outslug people. But they brought Michael Kadire in pretty much exclusively for that purpose. They spent the first-round draft pick on him. They ponied up the money because they thought he was the guy who could come in and add a little thump to the middle of their order. He's not doing that. He's not even remotely doing that. So until or unless that happens, it's really hard to expect other guys to produce more. I mean, maybe, yeah, you could expect a little more power from Duda just because we saw it last year. Maybe we could expect Curtis Granderson to pop one or two more out of the ballpark. But Kadire's really the guy. Kadire's the guy who was supposed to be the difference maker, and so far he hasn't been. If he can get to being that guy, and, you know, I don't know exactly what it will take for him to do that. Maybe he's reached a point in his career where he's not, and then that's just made a mistake. But I think they think there's still plenty in there. So if he can get the hitting balls out of the ballpark, or even just driving balls into the gaps, because he hasn't really been doing that either, it'll transform a lot of what's going on with this offense, and it could cure a lot of ills pretty quickly.
And, you know, as I mentioned, it will also help to get healthy. So to go over some of those guys, they made a move recently that seemed to indicate that David Wright wasn't as close as maybe we thought, and that's sort of proven out, as he's still not there. How far away is Wright? What's his status at the current time?
That's a big mystery. I think it's something that should be pretty concerning for the Mets at this point, because this started as just an innocent little hamstring injury, or as innocent as a hamstring injury can be, and then all of a sudden it turned into a lower back thing, and then you look up here and this week when the Mets are in Chicago, and David Wright has just sort of stopped doing stuff. He's not doing baseball activities. He's been inside in Florida just receiving treatment, and this is sort of becoming a thing that's lingering and lingering and lingering, and we've gotten to the point now where even if he goes out tomorrow and starts doing stuff and really gets back on that program, you're going to look up, and by the time he gets his rehab games and actually comes back, it's going to be another close to two-month absence for David Wright. This was exactly what the Mets feared coming into the season. We talked a lot about David Wright's health at age 32, what he's still capable of doing, what he is at this stage in his career. And I remember saying on the preseason podcast that the biggest thing was, I think the numbers will be there for him as long as he can stay on the field. Well, he hasn't. And that's a big deal for the Mets. We're talking about power production. We're talking about overall offensive production. David Wright remains the key, the catalyst to everything that the Mets are doing. And if he's not on the field, it's hard to expect major improvement. So in terms of when he can be back, I think it's a pretty big mystery at this point. I wouldn't expect him much before the start of June. It could even leak into June a little bit at this point. Like I said, by the time he gets done with getting back into shape, doing his rehab program, getting out and playing some minor league games. So it's I don't want to say another lost season for David Wright, but it's a lost couple of months, and they need him back as soon as they can.
As far as Travis d'Arnaud, who also, if he hits like he has over the last roughly two-thirds of the season or so, would also be a big help. What's his status?
Yeah, that one's a little more concrete. He had the broken pinky finger, and he's sort of progressing as they expected. That was a 6 to 8 week timetable when he first got hurt, and he's pretty much chugging along on that. I think you can expect him back in June at some point. And yeah, that would be a big boon for them, because while the Mets think the world of Kevin Plawecki, who's been receiving most of the starts behind the plate, his offense has been sputtering, tough to get going a little bit in the early going, and that's to be expected for a guy who has zero major league experience coming into the season. So the sooner they can get d'Arnaud back, and he's another guy who's had some major injury issues. He's missed a ton of time, both as a prospect and since he's gotten to the big league. So they need him back, but I think that's a much more clear-cut case that you know, when you look at that June timetable, he will be there, as opposed to David Wright, who it's more of a really who knows at this point.
Mark, can't have been a big surprise to anybody. Certainly wasn't a big surprise after the last couple of days. But, Mike Minor underwent shoulder surgery after an extensive time of hoping to get strong and trying to get right. Is there reason to believe, shoulder surgery is basically never a good thing, but is there reason to believe that maybe this is finally what gets Minor eventually to being right?
Yeah, I guess you never know exactly how somebody's going to bounce back from surgery, but you know, the frustration that he has felt over the last year were multiple surgeons. I believe it was at least four different surgeons, including Dr. James Andrews, looks at his shoulder, and they tell him, look, everything looks structurally sound. You know, they look at the MRIs, they do stretch him out, they do this and that, and everything seems to be fine. And obviously it wasn't, because every time he got on that mound and put the downward stress on that shoulder, it became a problem. The inflammation returned, and the last resort was this exploratory surgical procedure that he underwent this week, and that was the only way they were able to find it. There was some fraying and some damage to the labrum, and now that he at least knows what the problem was, he hopes to be able to return next year and get back to where he was at the end of the 2013 season, where he was, you know, quickly establishing himself as you know, a solid number two starter. He beat Zach Greinke in the playoffs that year over the course of about 50 starts going back to July 2012. He ranked up there among the top left-handers in terms of ERA. His career was heading in the right direction, and obviously the discomfort and frustration he has felt the last year has really bothered him. Now he has some hope that you know, that there is some relief in his future, and he'll be able to get back to where he was.
As for the current rotation, there's also some question there. Eric Stoltz's position sounds like is not entirely secure. What's the status there? This is something we've talked about previously already, but where does that stand right now?
Yeah, you know, he gave up two more home runs in Cincinnati the other night. Now, that's probably not unexpected. Here's a fly ball pitcher pitching in that ballpark. You know, certainly was not a great setting for him, but he hasn't really been good at all for the last three starts. He's given up two home runs in each start. You've got a couple kids that are close to being ready, Manny Banuelos and Matt Whistler there with Triple A Gwinnett. They've got a couple off days here this week, so they can skip Stoltz the next start. The next time they would need him is on the Saturday. I believe that is the 23rd, May 23rd, be the next time they need to have him make his turn there. So they could wait to have Benuelos make one more start and then fill in at that spot. Whistler is scheduled to start Friday for Gwinnett, so they could have him make that start and then have a couple of extra off days leading into that Saturday start. But I really think, you know, Freddie Gonzalez was noncommittal when asked about whether Stoltz was in the rotation, would remain in the rotation. But, you know, there's some of the other guys I've talked to within the front office that have indicated that this will be a serious discussion over the next few days. Where do you go from here? With Whistler, I think they would like to give him a few more starts before they get him up to the big leagues. They like the direction he's gone the last couple outings, but let's not forget he struggled throughout most of April. They kind of want to get him on a roll with Benuelos. He's on an innings limit. He's already thrown 37 innings, and because he only threw 76 innings last year coming off Tommy John surgery, they're looking to limit him to somewhere around 120 innings this year. So, you know, the question is, do you bring him up to the big leagues now, put him in a rotation, have him work a regular schedule, and then have to shut him down later in the season, or do you bring him up, work a regular schedule now, move him to the bullpen, and then bring him back to a starter role maybe later in the season if he's got some innings to play with? These are all things that they're going to be discussing. But, you know, at some point in time, I whether it happens this next turn or the one after, I do think Eric Stoltz's days in the rotation are numbered.
Willis is an interesting guy because he's never really harnessed his control, even in the upper minors, never mind at the major league level. Do they view him as a starter in the long run, or do they view him as a guy who essentially they'll keep starting to get him innings and development, but ultimately as a reliever in the long run?
You know, I think it's a very interesting. I think he's one of those guys that is at that point in his development where they're saying, look, we're going to continue to think of him as a starter, especially because there was so much uncertainty here the last couple of years with the arm problems that he's battled. They want to see exactly who he is. I would not be surprised if he does, you know, if you're saying take your best guess, what will he end up being? I do think he'll end up being a reliever. And he really could help this club at this point in time if he's able to throw strikes on a consistent basis in that relief role. But for now, I think maybe they're just going to continue to set him out there working five innings and at a time, trying to stretch him out and see where he stands and make more of an evaluation. But if you're taking your best guess right now, I do think he'll end up being a reliever long term.
And I guess the reason I ask that is sort of wondering about him versus Whistler. You know, one of those guys I think people think might be a part of a long term Braves rotation and one not. So. Is it fair to say that if they go with Benuelos, it's sort of that's kind of a reflection on Stoltz. They just have to go with somebody in there, whereas Whistler might be more like a Fultonevich, where you're really kind of plugging in the next piece of, I know they don't like the rebuilding word, but the next piece of this sort of restructuring for the next good Braves team.
Yeah, I do think so. I think that if you're projecting who's going to be in that rotation 2017, they want to make sure that Whistler goes through. They're going to take care of him as much as possible, make sure he does everything he needs to do at the minor league level because, you know, you've heard it time and again, you know, over the years. You know, once you bring a guy up, you don't necessarily want to send him back down if you don't have to. So, you know, make sure you're probably going to handle him with a little bit more care and make sure he does everything he needs to do to prepare to once he gets here, he doesn't have to go back down to the minors.
And then one other thing I wanted to touch on while we have you. I don't think anybody could have foreseen in February or March that Kelly Johnson getting hurt would be any kind of major blow to the Braves. But I think it's fair to say it is. And
yeah.
You know, given what they're dealing with offensively and a couple guys struggling, what do they do? I mean, it's kind of a tough spot that they're in with their offense now, and one of the guys who was contributing is going to be out for a while.
Well, you know, when I wrote those words last night, it did feel odd that you're saying this is a significant loss, and it really has, will be, because, you know, here's a guy who has really been one of the most consistent offensive performers over the last 2 or 3 weeks. He's fit in that cleanup spot. You know, hey, look, he's not the prototypical cleanup hitter, but when you look at that lineup, there really aren't that many good options, and he was performing well, providing Freddie Freeman whatever protection he could there. Now with him out, now you play A.J. Pierzynski on a consistent basis, or you could put him in there on a consistent basis. But as you've seen over the last couple of weeks, once A.J. Pierzynski's playing on a daily basis, he's not going to remain consistent at the plate. He's 38 years old. He's going to need some time. This is an offense that you know, we knew it was going to struggle. I didn't realize that Kelly Johnson being out, and also you've got Chris Johnson out at this point in time. That's two third base options out. Now all of a sudden, Alberto Carrasco is going to see a lot of time, quite possibly. So at third base, I think that moving forward, you know, we might start to see the next couple of weeks, you know, with Kelly Johnson being out. There was maybe some optimism with this offense over the last couple of weeks. We'll see exactly how much value he had been providing. You know, and the question is, you know, when do they opt to bring up Jose Peraza? He was pulled from today's game in the ninth inning, and I'm starting to make some calls and try to figure out why, because he was not injured. So we may be seeing him sometime soon as well.
All right, well, Mark Bowman potentially breaking news here on MLB.com Extras. Bill, we'll get to the good news in a sec because there's quite a bit of it with this Nationals team these days, but got to start with something that's odd and a little concerning. Steven Strasburg hasn't been really great at any point this year. He's definitely been sort of not up to, I think, expectations for most of the year, but two starts ago, he had some physical discomfort, came out early, and his last time out, he just got knocked around. What's going on with Strasburg?
You know, that's a great question. You know, I spoke to someone who's at the game in Arizona, and they said that he threw too many sliders, and that's not like him. And I don't know if that's really the case because, as you know, I was not there in Arizona, but you know, if that's the case, you know, that's not like him. He's known to throw a lot of fastballs, and I'm not going to say he's hurt. He doesn't look hurt to me. The only time he looked hurt was when they were at Nationals Park last week and he had the back discomfort. But other than that, I mean, he's looked fine to me. So, you know, you would hope that he's healthy, but it's hard for me to say. I mean, I'll find out more today, obviously.
It's very strange because, you know, a lot of the peripherals still look good. You know, he's not given up a ton of home runs. He gave up two last time out, but those are the second and third homers he's given up all year.
Right.
He's not walking a lot of guys. He's getting a decent number of strikeouts. The peripherals look pretty good, but he's just getting hit. That's a weird combination, and it really, again, it's not just the last two starts. It's kind of an all-year thing. What broadly are you seeing with Strasburg, not just these last two, but really most of the year? He's really only had one or two really strong starts this year.
You know, it's hard to say, Matthew, because, you know, all I've seen mostly is, like, he's been great every time he's been in the big leagues. And this is the first time where he's really faced failure. Even when he was 8-9 2 years ago, you know, that you can blame the team for not scoring enough runs. But I know it's hard for me to say. It's hard to say if he's hurt. You know, I was told he wasn't throwing enough fastballs. He took too many sliders in his last start. So, I mean, this is something I have to ask Steven Strasburg. I mean, next time he'll pitch will be Sunday in his hometown, San Diego, and hopefully he'll be ready to pitch in front of his family.
If he doesn't start getting right, I mean, I don't think anybody in any sane planet thinks this guy's coming out of the rotation. But are there options? Skip a start, give him an extra day, anything there any kind of options if Strasburg continues to struggle, or do they just ride it out because this guy's got to be good for them to be as good as they want to be?
Well, you know, obviously there's options. I mean, they have enough pitching, you know, they have pitching depth to really help throughout the season. So obviously they can give him a day off. You know, Matt Williams loves to take advantage of days off where he can skip somebody and someone else, you know, come in and pitch. That's what he did this past week with Strasburg, and he let Scherzer pitch Monday. But, yes, that could I mean that could happen. I mean, you have Tanner Roark, don't forget him. And, you know, they could go from to the minor leagues and take a chance on A.J. Cole again. And you just never know. But we'll see what happens.
All right, so enough of that. Let's start talking about the good news because, like I said, there's a lot of it here. The main thing that jumps out to me is this club scored 55 runs in the last six games. We've spent a lot of this year talking about the offense, and lately it's working. Now, part of that is you face the Diamondbacks pitching staff, and you face them at a place that's really good to hit in Phoenix. But still, what's different about this offense the last week or so that they are putting up these kind of runs?
Well, number one is Bryce Harper. He's carrying the team. I predicted early in the season that he was the key member of the team, that he could carry the team like Reggie Jackson did for the Yankees years ago. And he's doing that right now. But as I'm saying that, you know, this team is streaky. They were streaky last year. They did this last year. But you hope they can be consistent from this point forward to the playoffs, because by the time – you remember last year during the playoffs, you know, they couldn't hit a lick. So you hope they can be consistent – all year long, where everyone can really start hitting. Denard Span is leading off, and he's been great since he came back from his injury. It looks like Jason Wirth is coming around. Ryan Zimmerman's definitely coming around. And Wilson Ramos, I mean, they're expecting high hopes for him, too. So you hope that this offense can really be consistent all year long, and to me, that's the key.
Kind of want to drill down a little bit on Harper because, you know, to some extent it's obvious. I mean, he's got basically every tool except maybe a good but not great hit tool. But he's got the eye. He's got the power. I mean, everything is there for this guy to be an outstanding offensive player. So when it comes together like this, what is there one key? Is it just a matter of that's how good he is? Or is there one key that kind of clicks in when you see him go on a run like he's on right now?
Well, I think the key is that he's not going for home runs every time out. And I think Max Scherzer said it best, is that, you know, if someone tries to pitch him low and away, he tries to get a base hit to left field. And he did that several times last week. So I think that's a good sign. His walk totals are up. If you look at the on-base percentage, it's really high. And he's driving runs. I mean, yes, he's hitting the home runs, but I'm looking at the RBIs, the run scored, and also the on-base percentage. To me, that's key, and they're all high. And I'm expecting that to be really key, Matthew. I mean, and he's taking the ball the other way, too. That's another key. He's not pulling everything. I think this is going to be consistent. This is the type of year he's going to have all year long.
It really does jump out. You noted one of the things that is going on with him is not so much chasing and trying to do too much with pitches he can't do anything to. Now, I think we all recognize that's a smart thing to do. That's a sign of a good hitter. As he's started to do that, is that, do you think, a conscious decision, or is that just a matter of sort of something you're better able to do the more big league pitches you see?
I think that's a conscious decision. I mean, Bryce Harper made up his mind during spring training. He even said it, that he's going to play smarter, not only in defensively but offensively. And and part of the problem, too, Matthew, I mean, the guy was injured the last 2 years, and I think health has a lot to do with his great year, too. So I think as long as he stays healthy, he plays smart, then I think he's going to have an MVP-type season. That's just my opinion.
How has he looked to you defensively?
Much better. I think he looks better in right field than he did left. And why that is, I have no idea. But, you know, he's throwing out runners. He seems to have more range playing right field, and that's kind of strange because he didn't have that really playing left. But I think he's been if I had to rate him based on Stratomatic, I would give him a 2 right now.
I think that they would happily take that if you told them that coming into the year that he'd be that kind of player.
Yes, no question.
One other guy I wanted to touch on that you actually mentioned briefly, Denard Span is not only hitting well, he's hitting for power, which of all the things he does, I don't think anybody expected that. Guy's got 11 extra base hits in his last 12 games. I'm somewhat inclined to just say that's baseball, but do you see anything different about Span, that he's not only getting hits and getting on base, but getting extra base hits?
Well, he's always had the extra base hits. I mean, with the exception of the home runs, he always hit the doubles and stuff. But the home runs, I'm not expecting that to last. I mean, to me, you know, it happens sometimes. That's the way I look at it. And when it's all said and done, he'll probably have, 10 for the year. But, you know, the guy has been arguably their best leadoff hitter since I've been covering this team. And he's been phenomenal. He really has. And he's another reason the Nationals have been on this winning streak right now.
Joe, start with some news stuff here. Jared Cosart left his last start due to what appeared to be a minor injury. But it's always worrisome when a member of your rotation is dealing with anything at all. What do you know right now about Cosart's situation?
Yeah, I think we're going to learn more very soon. He experienced a tight hamstring. He said didn't know if he got it when he got the hit the other day in L.A. and was running the bases, but when he threw that last pitch of the night and Grandal got a single to right, it went through the hole. He made a quick reaction. I guess he was going to cover first, and, you know, something didn't feel totally right in his hammy. They're hoping it's minor. Matt Latos dealt with something similarly a week or so ago. And he pitched through it. He ended up not missing a start. But Jared didn't seem overly concerned, but he hadn't been throwing very well to begin with. And his push-off leg, I would be kind of startled if he didn't at least get pushed back a few days. But, Cozart's situation, certainly something to monitor.
What exactly is the alternative if they do decide, either through necessity or just through caution, to give him a little extra time?
I think it's Henderson Alvarez. I think that could be making the decision for the Marlins. He did very well in his rehab start against Jupiter. Now you don't pay attention so much to the level of competition being a ball, but just the way he's throwing and how he's feeling. My concern would be I would have liked to see him do, you know, he faced extended spring hitters in the game situation. He had a full rehab start. And they were weighing whether to go one more rehab start, perhaps sending him up to Jacksonville for Double-A, and then getting him here. And then, you know, after that, but he's lined up to go Sunday if they need him, and they could just kind of slot him wherever Cosart is if they want to go that route. If Jared either needs a couple of days or DL is in his horizon, so I think Alvarez could be sooner rather than later.
And. The line, as you note, looks very good. What have you heard just about kind of how Alvarez has looked as far as, you know, sharpness, crispness, stuff, the kind of stuff that somebody there would be able to know?
Velo about 93, which was encouraging to them. Didn't walk anyone, which is always encouraging. And, you know, Henderson's one of those guys that, you know, we've talked about him before. He's a little bit like a rubber band. He kind of bends, he stretches, and he kind of comes back. And I wouldn't worry too much about him. I probably, like I said, in the perfect world, you like him to get as sharp as possible and not, you know, have a bad outing or two before he finds his stride. But they're seeing everything they want to see. But then again, this is a team struggling to get to 500 and then try to make a real run at this thing. So they might be wishful seeing as well. So, but all, you know, I think if he came back, he'd be perfectly fine. But, you know, it is Henderson Alvarez, and I think the fact that he is, you know, pretty much besides Jose the best they got, they are confident if he says he feels well that they will let him come pitch up here.
The other big issue, the biggest issue it seems right now facing the Marlins is the ninth inning. As of now, it seems like they are sort of mixing and matching first of all, just kind of how do you see that going as we go forward? Do you see it likely that somebody emerges? Do you see it likely that Cishek reclaims that at some point? How do you see that kind of shaking down as the weeks go by here?
Yeah, and it's pretty much, you know, they would have had a very successful road trip in Washington, San Fran, and in L.A. They would have won 7 games. Instead, they found themselves winning 4. You know, they had those, you know, 3 blown saves, 2 by Cishek, leading to him being kind of pushed down to let's try to fix him. I think A.J. Ramos, even though they will mix and match, will get probably the bulk of the opportunities. I think that they really, you know, obviously didn't want to see Cozart get hurt, but I think they kind of look at, you know, get the starters back and then get either Kohler or Phelps in the bullpen to help the back end. And the way Phelps is thrown, he, even though he opened the season in the bullpen and Kohler in the rotation, I wouldn't be shocked if Tommy Kohler is the guy that goes to the bullpen to kind of, you know, add depth, not necessarily to close, but to kind of maybe handle the 8. And allow Dunn and Ramos to kind of figure it out in the 9th. And Matthew, make no mistake, they need Cishek to be really good. I mean, they're not going to sign Rafael Soriano. They worked him out. Didn't think he was better than what they already have. You know, trading at this point is very difficult. And, you know, a lot of teams are still, you know, saying they're in it. So they got to make do with what they have. And Cishek's been so good until this year. So, you know, he was talking a little bit about, you know, physically he says he's fine, which whenever you see a decline like this, you're always concerned. He said mechanically, you know, he throws sidearm at that arm angle is just even lower than before, not getting it, even though he throws sidearm over the ball to get that ball down and getting that sinking motion instead of that sweeping across the plate motion that's, you know, getting completely crushed right now. So, you know, I think you're looking at Ramos and Dunn kind of finishing up the 9th, but, you know, get the bullpen stronger with a starter to join the late innings and get Cishek right. And hopefully in a month or so, he could get back and, you know, also be the closer if Ramos takes off with it to give him 2 options. I think that's their perfect scenario right now.
Is Papelbon anywhere on the radar? Is that a viable option in any way?
I just see what it would take to get him. I don't see them, you know, they gave up so much already in the offseason. They don't have as deep a system. And, yeah, like a K-Rod as well, you know, it's, you know, what are you going to give up? How much do you want to, you know, the Phillies aren't going to give him away, and I think there's going to be a lot of need. But, yeah, you know, you could always go that route. I just don't see it. You know, it's going to cost them a lot. And I'm not sure that, you know, they're willing to do that or they even have the pieces to get Papelbon.
To go back to Cishek for a minute, you know, you say he says, I feel fine. And, you know, a lot of times a guy can feel fine and still not be right because there's just some little fine thing that keeps him from being there. And I'm looking it up here. Cishek's velocity is significantly down. Now, I know he's not a 96 blow-by-you guy, but even so, when somebody's down 2 miles an hour, a lot of times that's an indicator of something being amiss. Is that something they're talking about? And, in fact, down on the slider, too, is that something they're talking about? Is that something that is on the radar, or is everybody...
It's more on my radar, Matthew. No, and you're going to have to give the veteran the benefit of the doubt that, okay, let's see how he does. But, you know, that arm action has always been a concern. You know, it's not an orthodox style of throwing. It's natural for him, but, you know, that elbow moving that way, there's always a concern. He's going to be 29 in June. So, you know, is all the years finally catching up to that arm and that arm action. So it is something they have to be looking at. You know, they have to go by what the player says, and he's not seeming to be laboring in any way physically. Another thing with Steve, yes, the velo, if he could get it back, he hit 92 the other day, but, you know, what good is it if it's, you know, flat over the plate? So with him, it's there. He's kind of traditionally, as the weather warms up, his arm tends to get a little looser and he starts throwing a little harder. Ramos, we saw that with him. He's throwing 94 now. His velo had been down. So you know, these guys, obviously, the more they build up, it can go up. But I'm with you. It's definitely based on that delivery and all the usage and the fact that he's always been healthy, and we just know pitchers, eventually it happens to him. It's something definitely to monitor.
What is it that that makes Ramos, if not alone, kind of sounds like maybe first among equals is kind of the way to put that?
Well, he really passed a test the other day in L.A. That was quite impressive. In facing three lefties, getting two quick strikeouts and a lazy fly ball to right to end it against three pretty good hitters. With A.J., his stuff is really good. The slider's really good. The fastball's got life. Like I say, it's hitting 93, 94. Again, it's not the ideal closer. It's not Kimbrel or Chapman, you know, bringing, you know, 99 to 103. But, you know, there's enough there. The changeup against the lefties was really good. And he just looked comfortable in it. You know, he was given this opportunity like a year or so ago when Steve was struggling. And he came in and it didn't go so well. He's had blown saves, but those were always in innings, you know, 8 and 7 or whatever. But, you know, it looks like, again, this team right now, they can't say you're my closer and you're my, you know, he's got to earn that. You know, one save doesn't make a closer, but he did show that he was up to the task, you know, and getting guys out at Dodger Stadium in that environment, you know, that was very encouraging as well. So as long as he doesn't walk guys, that's always been AJ's knock. You know, he sometimes comes in 3-0 and then he gets in trouble or he walks the leadoff guy. You know, that's going to be key. AJ is going to have to, you know, pound the strike zone, and if he does, he's very difficult to hit.
And that actually is my last question. He's walking fewer guys this year, and he walked a terrifying number of guys the last 2 years. Two every three innings last year, one every two innings the year before that. That rate is down. Now, admittedly, it's very early, and it only takes a couple for that number to look different. But do you think he's really kind of turned a corner as far as throwing strikes and controlling the strike zone, or is it still not? Are you still not sort of willing to?
Yeah, I'm not 100% there, Matthew. But again, he's been very good. He's been their best reliever this year, and that's you know a bullpen that hasn't been very good. But all you have to do is kind of just watch and see, you know. But he's going to have to do it. There's no question. You know, am I totally confident he's not going to, you know, have a guy on first, no out, in a one-run game all the time? No, you know, he's got the stuff to get guys out. He's just going to have to, you know, just really program himself to come out throwing strikes. And he was very good the other day because both his first two batters, 0-2, before he threw a ball, which obviously there you're looking for him to chase something or whatever. So as long as he's around the plate and you know, pound that strike zone, I think he can, you know, be good enough for them to get where they want. Another thing, too, they have this in mind, whether Cishek returns to form to be a closing option between now and September. They know, and we've seen a lot of teams, you need that. If you're going to the playoffs, you kind of need that second guy that, unless you have Mariano Rivera, who never faltered, who's going to have to be there to pick you up. And so I think if they're hanging around like they think they're going to be, and if Cichek's not doing it by the deadline, you might see some type of, you know, more serious thinking of a trade. But I do think that they want at least two closing options as this season, you know, pushes forward.
Todd, Jonathan Papelbon just set the Phillies franchise save record. He is closing on a team that is not hitting or pitching or doing much of anything well, and yet he is pitching really well. All he has left on his contract is a vesting option. Given that he has now accomplished presumably the one individual goal that was left for him and all the rest of it, why is Papelbon still a Philly?
Well, right now, I think it just comes down to the fact that the Phillies have not been terribly excited about anything that they've gotten in terms of offers for him. You know, there was a lot of talk before spring training, in spring training, about the Brewers and the Blue Jays having some interest in him. And it depends on who you talk to. Some people say that the Phillies are asking for too much for some of their guys. The Phillies will say, if you only knew some of the offers that we got for some of these guys, you would feel that way. And so I think right now they're just trying to get get what they consider to be something fair for him, and rightly or wrongly, they don't feel that they've gotten anything for him. But I got to think, when it's August 1st, I would be very surprised if Jonathan Papelbon is still a member of the Phillies. I just think this season is probably even worse than the Phillies' front office thought it might be, and I just think they're really motivated to trade some of these guys. So I think ultimately it is going to get done, but so far they haven't been too excited about what they've been offered for him.
Right. I mean, that you kind of hit on what I was going to ask next, which is, out of all of these guys that they could move, and it's a surprisingly high number when you really sit down and look at it, he seems to be the most compelling from a combination of he's one guy who's actually playing well. It's an obvious need for at least a couple of teams that consider themselves contenders. And again, he makes a lot of money, but we're at a point now where you're still only talking about a year and a half, and if he went on the open market, he'd almost certainly get more than what that 2016 option is. So do you think it is fair to say that of all these guys, Hamels, Utley, Howard, the second-tier guys, Revere, Ruiz, whoever it may be, he's the one guy that it seems most hard to imagine that doesn't get moved in the next 2.5 months?
Yeah, I think so, certainly. And for another reason is, the Phillies, I think, are willing to eat some of that contract. I'm not saying they're going to, like, you know, hey, we'll eat 85% of it or 75% of it, but they are willing, I believe, to take on some of his contract, including the vesting option next season, to get a player or players back that they feel that they deserve or warrant if they do trade somebody like Jonathan Papelbon. So there's definitely a willingness on the Phillies' side. And I think they just want, you know, Pat Gillick has said this multiple times. When I go out and try to make a trade for a player, you know, I don't try to rob the other team blind. You know, I want something that's fair. And again, depends on who you talk to. The Phillies say they haven't gotten any sort of quote unquote fair offers for any of their players yet.
Do you think with what's going on in Miami, is there a potential fit there, or is that, I mean, I wouldn't think the Phillies would worry about trading in division. Is there maybe some idea that the Marlins wouldn't want to give up a prospect that might beat them face-to-face? Or is that seems to be another place where maybe there's a potential fit for a team looking for a guy in the ninth.
Absolutely. You know what? I think in years past, maybe the Phillies would have been less inclined to trade a player to a division rival. But because they are, I think they're so far removed from being a competitive team right now. I mean, this is, you know, 2017 at the absolute earliest, the way things are looking right now, I don't think that they would say, you know what, let me put it this way. If it was 2007 or something like that and they were going to trade a closer to the Mets, they probably wouldn't do it. But if they help out the Marlins for the next year and a half, I don't think that's going to cost the Phillies anything in the long run. So I don't think on the Phillies' end there would be any hesitation on their part. But you're right, maybe the Marlins would be like, well, do we want to give up this prospect and maybe have him come back to haunt us in a couple of years. But on the other hand, if you can help your team now and you think your team can win, sometimes you just have to pull the trigger and go for it and just let the chips fall where they may. And, you know, hey, the Phillies are a great example of that. They made some really big trades trying to go for it for several seasons. And you know, looking back, you know, I still think they would make some of those trades, but none of those guys have really come back to haunt them. So, you know, prospects are just prospects.
Speaking of prospects, there's no other segue between these two topics, but you gave me one, so I appreciate that. It seems that we are rapidly approaching the Michael Franco era, perhaps down to an any day now kind of situation. First of all, how imminent is his arrival?
I would be surprised if he is not up in the big leagues by Friday, which is the series opener against the Diamondbacks. And I would be stunned if he's not up before the end of the weekend. Michael Franco has to spend 40 days in the minor leagues this year to allow the Phillies to push back his free agency from 2020 to 2021, which is a huge thing for a rebuilding team. And so it would be absolutely no earlier than Thursday. And if they did it Thursday or earlier, I would be floored. I wouldn't understand it at all. Friday makes perfect sense. The fact that Cody Ashe is already in AAA leads me to think that once Friday comes, Michael Franco will be here. So surprised if Michael Franco is not here Friday. Absolutely floored and stunned if he's not here before the end of the weekend.
What is the difference? I mean, just aside from experience and sort of natural improvement, what is the difference between Franco this year and Franco a year ago when he started out slowly and there seemed to be some uncertainty as to exactly how ready he was?
Well, I think one thing that people forget about Michael Franco is that he's a very young player. I believe he's 21, 22 right now. And, every year he's kind of come up to the system. He struggled a little bit earlier in the season. And that was a case with him last year. He started last season very, very slow with Lehigh Valley, came on strong towards the end, got called up by the Phillies, struggled in September in very limited action, played very well in winter ball. But then he comes into spring training, doesn't perform in spring training. So the Phillies, though, are happy with his progress. I think he's got a little bit more experience right now. And I think they're finally hoping that, okay, he's played a couple years of winter ball. He's spent now more than a season in AAA. He's already gotten his feet wet a little bit in the big leagues with the Phillies last September, that when he comes up, he might not be hitting 340 like he is right now, but certainly they hope that he can be a productive right-handed bat in this lineup. And I'll say this, Matthew, defensively, the guy is very solid, very, in my opinion, an above-average defensive third baseman. Got a lot of great reports from him in AAA this season. So certainly defensively, it's going to be a big upgrade over what Cody Ashby provided so far this year.
What kind of upside does he have as a big leaguer? I mean, is this a guy who they think and you think is going to be an all-star kind of player?
I think that they think that he has that potential. He has that potential to be a right-handed, power-hitting corner infielder that plays really good defense. And so I definitely think that they, if they dream hard enough that they could picture him as an all-star. But at the very least, I feel that they look at him as a middle-of-the-order type of guy that you can kind of build a lineup around. Maybe not a number three hitter, maybe not a number four hitter, but, a number five type guy. You think back to some of the number five type guys that they've had over the years, Pat Burrell, Jason Worth, a guy that can pop 25 home runs in a season, 80, 90, 100 RBIs in that ballpark. And again, play really, really good defense to go along with it.
How will they, once he does arrive, how will they handle him? Will it be pretty much play every day, get those at-bats, or will they kind of still try to choose matchups to some extent and kind of make sure to, for lack of a better word, kind of shelter him in some ways?
Well, I think there could be a little bit, every once in a while, maybe pull him against a really tough right-hander. But when I talked with Ruben Amaro Jr. in St. Louis a few weeks ago, and then when he talked again about it just the other day here in Philadelphia, he said when Michael Franco is promoted, he expects him to play nearly every day. And I think that is the right thing to do. You don't want to call up Michael Franco and make him a platoon type of guy. You want this guy to get a lot of experience. This is the season to do it. There's nothing to lose by playing him every day. And I think that is definitely a plan, which, again, goes back to sending Cody Ashby to AAA to learn how to play an entirely different position. So that right there tells you that they're not thinking platoon. They're not really thinking matchup, because if they were thinking possible platoon matchup, you could just have Cody Ashby start against the right-handed hitters, and Michael Franco start against a lot of right-handed pitchers. Kind of go that platoon situation. But clearly, that's not the way they're thinking right now. Which I completely agree with. I think if Michael Franco comes up, you got to play this guy every single day.
So what do they do with Ashby when he comes back? Does he become more or less the left fielder, or is that not quite so clear?
I think when he comes back, they look at him as a left fielder. But going forward, you see Ben Revere moving to right field. You see Dominic Brown eventually getting promoted and playing some right field. And then you go, okay, they still got Darren Ruff. They got Jeff Francoeur. They've got Grady Sizemore. They've got Adubel Herrera in center field. Not all these guys can fit on the roster. So I think some things are going to be happening fairly soon, because again, they see Ashby as a left fielder, and I think they see him playing most every day as a left fielder. So I think they're definitely going to be looking to trade either Dominic Brown or Ben Revere. I think the Orange County Register the other day wrote that Ben Revere is being looked at by the Angels. And so any team that kind of would need a speedy kind of outfielder that can play all three outfield positions with no arm, no power, mind you, but still get on base, steal some bases, hit for a high average, I think, you know, Ben Revere could be attractive for some teams. And quite frankly, I don't think he would cost a team a heck of a lot. So, you know, Ben Revere, Dominic Brown maybe move to kind of free up some spots for the rest of these guys.
This is MLB.com Extras. Thanks, everybody, for listening.